From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
My concern that I'm having most recently with my husband being in Iraq is that he was recently transferred to a different army base without any notification, and I fear that it's related to my speaking out and the concerns that he's told me that I've related to the media.
On this military... On this Veterans Day special, we'll hear from families who lost loved ones in the Gulf, whose husbands are currently in the Gulf, and we'll talk to a 25-year Pentagon veteran. He worked intelligence on the 9/11 attacks. Now he says the invasion is wrong. But first, the Supreme Court takes its first case on Guantanamo detainees.
In a blow to the administration, the Supreme Court agreed to review the question of whether courts in the United States could review the detentions of those held at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Supreme Court agreed yesterday to decide whether prisoners at a U.S. military prison in Guantanamo Bay are entitled to access to civilian courts to challenge their open-ended detention. It's the first time the justices will decide a case on the Bush administration's anti-terrorism policy. We'll have more on that in just a minute. On Capitol Hill, a group of 26 members of Congress introduced a resolution Monday urging President Bush to fire Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. One of the bill's sponsors, Congressmember Charles Rangel of New York, said, quote, "The first step to bringing our troops home is to send Donald Rumsfeld home." Meanwhile, in Baghdad, U.S. soldiers have shot dead a member of the U.S.-appointed local Iraqi council in Sadr City. The council leader, Mohammed Kabi, was killed while he was approaching the council offices on Sunday. The U.S. claims he attempted to take a weapon from a soldier when the troops stopped him and asked to search his car. Local residents said he never attempted to grab a weapon. One city hall employee said, quote, "It was killing for the sake of killing. It was not self-defense." Also in Iraq, U.S. forces have detained 20 men who are being questioned about possible ties to al-Qaeda. A new report by the medical charity MedAct estimates between 22,000 and 55,000 Iraqis died as a result, a direct result, of the invasion. The study examined the health and environmental costs of war. The author of the report told the BBC, quote, "There has been a reported increase in maternal mortality rates. Acute malnutrition has almost doubled in the last year, and there's an increase in waterborne diseases and vaccine-preventable diseases." A new poll has found 49% of Americans now believe the invasion of Iraq was not worth it. About 48% of the population says it was, according to a new poll conducted by the Annenberg Public Policy Center. This marks the first time this poll found more Americans were opposed to the invasion. In Afghanistan, at least one person has been injured after a car bomb exploded outside the United Nations offices in Kandahar. Police in Miami announced yesterday plans to embed reporters in police squads during the upcoming protests against the Free Trade Area of the Americas. Police Chief John Timoney says he wants to bring journalists to the front lines of the protest. The journalists will be required to have a riot helmet and gas mask. Timoney gained national attention in 2000 when he served as police chief in Philadelphia during the Republican National Convention. A confidential report by the International Atomic Energy Agency has found that over the past 18 years, Iran has secretly manufactured small amounts of enriched uranium and plutonium. This according to the Washington Post, which obtained a copy of the report. The agency also said it's found no evidence that Iran had not sought to build a nuclear bomb. But the agency concluded, quote, "It'll take some time before the agency is able to conclude that Iran's nuclear program is exclusively for peaceful purposes." The World Trade Organization ruled yesterday that the president has broken international law by imposing tariffs on imported steel. If Bush does not eliminate the tariffs, other nations could impose a total of $2.2 billion in punitive duties on some U.S. exports. $2.2 billion is the largest sanctions ever handed down by the World Trade Organization. In Guatemala, voters have rejected an attempt by former military dictator Rios Montt to become president. In the first round of voting, Montt received less than 20% of the vote. A runoff will now be held on December 28th between the two top vote-getters, businessman Oscar Berger and the industrial engineer Alvaro Colón. Maksum here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Supreme Court agreed yesterday to decide whether prisoners at Guantanamo Bay are entitled to access to civilian courts to challenge their open-ended detention. It's the first time the justices will decide a case on the Bush administration's anti-terrorism policy. The New York Times describes the decision as, quote, an unmistakable rebuff of the Bush administration's position. The U.S. considers the detainees enemy combatants, not prisoners of war who are entitled to specific protections under international law. The court said it would resolve only the jurisdictional question of whether the federal courts can hear such a challenge and not whether these detentions are in fact unconstitutional. The appeals were made by a group of 16 detainees, including 2 British, 2 Australian, and 12 Kuwaiti, held for more than 18 months without access to their families or to lawyers, and held without any charges brought against them. They're among about 660 detainees from more than 40 countries that are being held at the U.S. Navy base in Cuba following their capture during the war in Afghanistan. Michael Ratner is one of their attorneys. He's president of the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York. Welcome to Democracy Now!,
Michael. Nice to see you, Amy.
So, talk about the significance of this decision.
Well, we were very excited by it because you have to understand the government won in the district court and it won in the Court of Appeals on the theory that the executive could do whatever it wanted with whomever it wanted at Guantanamo Bay and that the courts should play no role whatsoever. So the fact that the Supreme Court stepped in here and said, no, we want to at least consider the question of whether courts can hear whether the rights of the people at Guantanamo have been violated is a very, very significant ruling. Look, we're not home at all by this ruling in a long way, but it is, I think, a real blow to the Bush administration to have the Supreme Court step in here.
The court said it would resolve only the jurisdictional question of whether the federal courts can hear such a challenge, not whether these detentions are unconstitutional. Can you explain what that means?
Right. What that means is the government has asserted that because these people are on Guantanamo Bay or in the government's view, outside the United States, that no court in the United States can hear any of the cases. That you can go into a court, but the court will just throw you out because the U.S. courts have no jurisdiction over Guantanamo. What the Supreme Court is saying is, no, we're going to look at that question. Can a U.S. court hear what's happening in Guantanamo Bay? We had a similar situation with the Haitian refugees in 91. We did get the Second Circuit Court of Appeals to say, yes, we can look at what's happening to the Haitians in Guantanamo. Now, what they've done is they've said we might take jurisdiction of the case and say courts can hear it, but we're not going to decide whether holding people without a hearing is necessarily constitutional or not. We're going to say there might be jurisdiction, but we're going to probably send that back to a lower court to decide whether or not there's a violation of the Constitution.
Tell us about your clients. Who are these men?
Well, you know, there's a variety of people there. Obviously, there's 660. I represent personally, along with the center and some other lawyers, two people from Australia and two people from the United Kingdom. They were people picked up, according to the government, again, we don't know, in Pakistan and in Afghanistan. The government has claims about them, but has really not asserted what they did wrong, other than possibly some of them may have fought with the Taliban. Some of them were civilians picked up in Pakistan. The 12 Kuwaitis were apparently all in Pakistan, all civilians. The answer is we've never had access to them. They don't even know I represent them. I represent their families. They don't get to see any attorney, any of their families. They're held incommunicado. So I only know what the government tells me, and it's very, very slim. Mm.
We had you on when we had the father of the Australian detainee, David Hicks, on, and he had come to New York and stood in a cage outside your offices in an orange jumpsuit to show what it was like. He said he has retraced his son's steps in Afghanistan, even interviewed the commander of the base, the Afghan commander of the base, who said that his son would not have been taken if he had been there at the time.
Right. I mean, David Hicks's father is a wonderful man. He built this cage on Broadway, stood in it in a jumpsuit for 2 hours. He's not a Muslim himself. His son is converted to Muslim, but is very supportive of his son and said, look, my son deserves to have some kind of a hearing as to whether he should be kept there. He's been there almost 2 years now, and why no hearing? And why was he picked up? A lot of these people were picked up because the U.S. was bribing people, was saying to people, point us, who are the leaders of Al-Qaeda? Point them out. Well, someone gets, you know, whatever the bribes were, and they said they identify their enemy. And that's actually, a lot of the people here are probably innocent of everything, much less, you know, just say they fought on behalf of the Taliban. That doesn't make them into war criminals if they fought on behalf of the Taliban. We may not like what they did, but it doesn't make them incarcerated in Guantanamo.
We're talking to Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, about the ruling of the Supreme Court, to the surprise of many, agreeing to decide whether prisoners at the U.S. military prison in Guantanamo Bay are entitled to access to civilian courts to challenge their open-ended detention. What does this mean for prisoners like Jose Padilla?
Well, I think it's significant for people like Jose Padilla, because if the court is willing to review whether or not people in Guantanamo have some rights, people like Jose Padilla, who are here in the United States and, according, you know, given more rights because the U.S. citizens, should be given, you know, substantial rights. Padilla, of course, does have a case in court. But
he's an American citizen who is labeled an enemy combatant.
Right. Padilla is the so-called dirty bomber. I mean, I hesitate to use that word because they've never come up with any evidence about that. That's what they call him. He is in an American court. He's never been given access to an attorney. He did get to bring a writ of habeas corpus in an American court, and his case is going to be argued soon in the Second Circuit in New York. But it does seem to me that the court stepping in the Guantanamo cases is a real warning sign to courts deciding these enemy combatant cases in the United States. It's saying, look, be careful here. You're dealing with real human beings with real rights. You can't just ignore them when the Bush administration says this is the commander-in-chief power. We can do whatever we want. The court is basically setting up a red flag. You can't do whatever you want. So it's a very significant that the court stepped in here.
Hmm. I wanted to move to another decision of the Bush administration and ask you about the case. On December 21st, 1989, George Bush Sr., as president, was holding a press conference about the U.S. intervention in Panama as the first U.S. fatalities from the conflict were arriving at Dover Air Base. With General Manuel Noriega still at large and half of the United States believing the military intervention could not be regarded as a success while he remained so, it was a politically sensitive time. At the beginning of the briefing, the president told reporters he was suffering from neck pain. At the end, he did a duck walk to illustrate his stiffness. That's when the goofometer went off the charts, as one correspondent put it. Unbeknownst to the White House, three major news networks had moved to a split screen. While the president shared his lighthearted moment with the press corps on one half, America's dead were arriving in caskets on the other. It was a public relations disaster. The White House spokesperson, Marlon Fitzwater, described the coverage as outrageous and unfair and vowed to express his extreme dissatisfaction to the channels concerned. Less than a year later, the White House decreed a ban on traditional military ceremonies and media coverage, marking the return of the bodies of U.S. soldiers to Dover. It was an abrupt shift in policy for what had become a national wartime ritual. Along with yellow ribbons and flag waving, the scenes from Dover were part of the American war experience. For the next 12 years, the ban was largely ignored, even after it was extended to all military bases during the last days of the Clinton administration. But this March, shortly before the invasion began, the Pentagon handed down a directive that made it perfectly clear it expected the policy to be heeded. No videotape or photographs of the coffins coming home. Your response to this, Michael Ratner?
Well, you understand that, first of all, in 91, this policy was implemented in the first Iraq War, and it was actually litigated, and it, unfortunately, was lost. Basically, the court said these are military bases, and the First Amendment doesn't guarantee you access. But what's obviously going on here is manipulation of the media. What's going on here clearly is they don't want to see the American people to see the people, the dead bodies coming home. And we know that really clearly because if you remember when Johnny Spahn was killed, the CIA agent in Afghanistan, he was not, his pictures were not forbidden. In fact, the U.S. did a huge event bringing his body back really to get people angry about the war and to get them into the war in Afghanistan. So they obviously are using these images to manipulate how the American people feel. Spahn's body gets brought back to Dover. Huge, not celebration, but a huge event. Other bodies brought back, absolute quiet.
You know, it's interesting. On Friday morning, on Morning Edition on NPR, there was a very moving commentary by a woman who lost her son. And she described how when they were in the midst of their grieving at home, the cameras were all there taking pictures of her garage door and her front door, and she couldn't stand it. But she said the one public moment was when the body of her son was being brought home. And her whole family turned out in military uniform from the different wars to show their respect that he was a hero. That was the moment that she was willing to share with the world to honor her son. There she was at the hangar with her family, but there were no cameras there except for a military videographer. She didn't mention at that point, and I assume that she didn't know, that the cameras cannot be there. She implied her hurt, that this was the moment that she would be honored by the world spotlight on her son's casket. But now, no pictures. Most people don't realize this. Most people don't realize they're not seeing caskets now. What does it mean to say it was litigated 10 years ago? Why then can't the media go on to Dover Air Base?
Well, it was litigated, which means, unfortunately, it was lost 10 years ago, that the media lost the court decision, and then the war ended, so I think it never was appealed. But the decision was that it's a military base, and therefore it's owned by the government, and the government can decide access to that base, and the First Amendment rights of all of us out here.
If the press made a bigger deal of it?
Well, I think that's what I was going to say. I think, first of all, I think we're ready to do another litigation on this and to bring together a lot of press people to do it. But I think the litigation itself is not enough. The press has to really be out there objecting. But the problem here is you read the papers every day, you don't even know Americans died. So what's the press's interest? You know, the Times puts little squibs in, you know, soldier killed. If they were to have a big black box every day with the picture of a soldier or something being killed, that might be different. So the press so far has been basically totally tame on this issue and outrageously so. They should be out there really objecting. Hopefully, if we get together to bring another litigation, we'll be able to get a lot of press people behind it.
Michael Ratner, president of Center for Constitutional Rights, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Amy.
You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, two women whose husbands are in Iraq right now, another who lost her son in Iraq. We'll also speak with a 25-year veteran who was brought out of retirement to do intelligence on the 9/11 attacks. Today, he's outside Walter Reed Hospital, and he is protesting. We'll be back in a minute.
He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist. blind a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA. And he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way. And he's fighting for democracy, he's fighting for the Reds, he says it's for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die, and he never sees the writing on the wall. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Dachau? Without him, Caesar would have stood alone.
Universal Soldier, Buffy St. Marie here on Democracy Now!'s Veterans Day special. I'm Amy Goodman. Today is Veterans Day. We're going to spend the rest of the hour hearing from veterans, families who've lost loved ones, as well as two women whose husbands are currently deployed in Iraq. Today, a number of veterans groups are protesting outside Walter Reed Medical Center in Maryland, the main hospital treating returning wounded soldiers. Their protest comes as a new report in the military newspaper Stars and Stripes reveals more than 7,000 wounded U.S. soldiers have been treated at a single U.S. military hospital, Landstuhl Regional Military Center, a medical center in Germany. The counts of wounded treated at other U.S. military hospitals are unknown. Some veterans groups are calling for an immediate investigation to determine how and why the U.S. military is downplaying or concealing the high number of wounded. According to Pentagon figures, nearly 400 U.S. soldiers have died in Iraq since the invasion began in March. Meanwhile, President Bush has still yet to attend the funeral of a single U.S. soldier killed in action since Bush took office, and his administration is maintaining a ban on journalists filming caskets returning to the U.S. from Iraq and Afghanistan. The latest polls say nearly half of Americans now say the Iraq war was not worth it. We turn first to Jane Bright, who is the mother of Sergeant Evan Ashcroft, who died on July 24th, along with two other U.S. soldiers in an ambush near Mosul. Evan was 24 years old. Jane Bright, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Can you talk about your son? I know you visited his grave yesterday.
Yes, I was there. I'm there as often as I can be. I'll be there again today. Evan was what so many of these young people are. He was a leader. He'd been a team leader for quite some time prior to being promoted to sergeant. His team loved him. I've talked to some of them. He was very, very intelligent. He played classical piano. He had a really bright future, and so many of these young people have that type of history and strong family support. And the first thing that comes to mind when I think of what's going on over there is we're killing off our next generation, and we're sitting by and we're watching it happen.
Can you talk about the Bush administration's handling of the invasion, your thoughts when your son first went and your thoughts today?
I had been very vocal about my anti-war sentiments. Evan knew how I felt. We agreed as he was leaving that my feelings about the war were not the issue, that the issue was for him to go, do his job, come home, be safe. In terms of the Bush administration, I think that it is, well, I don't think, it's obvious. If you go online, if you pick up any newspaper, there are no weapons of mass destruction. There was no imminent threat from Iraq. Iraq has turned out to be a relatively powerless country. We invaded a sovereign state. My son died for oil. They're all dying for oil. They're all dying for, they being, you know, the young Americans, the men, the women. They're dying for so the United States, so that this administration can dominate the world or begin the process of world domination. This preemption is is what they're there for.
We're also joined on the phone by Candace Robinson. Her husband, Army First Lieutenant Mike Robinson, is stationed with the 82nd Airborne Division in Fallujah. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
You are speaking out. Your husband is in Iraq. What are his feelings about this?
He supports me 100% what I'm doing. Obviously, I can't speak for him, and our political beliefs are on opposite ends of the spectrum. Now, he has had some frustration over the way things have been handled, especially post-war, but he kind of does his thing and I do mine, and we just both choose to support each other.
What are you doing to voice your opposition here in the United States?
Well, August 18th, I organized a rally in Crawford while Bush was there on one of his many vacations. And September 9th, I went to D.C. and spoke at a congressional briefing that was sponsored by Congresswoman Maxine Waters. I was part of a press conference this weekend in San Antonio that was all military families speaking out about their soldiers still being in Iraq and the situation there. And then I do a lot of writing to my senators and my congressmen. I think they see my name on the outside of an envelope and cringe because it's me again. And of course, today my daughter is wearing a shirt to school that says troops. The Texas are upon you, because I don't think the kids should be in school today.
What does her T-shirt say?
It says, troops, the heart of Texans are upon you. And it's a shirt from Texans for Peace.
We're also joined on the phone by Jerry Sheesy, whose husband, Douglas Salaweski, is in Iraq, where he was tasked with setting up Iraqi media. Jerry, your thoughts on this Veterans Day?
Well, first, I'd like to tell everybody that I have the utmost respect to all the soldiers that have fought in any of the past wars. It's certainly nothing against them. This current war that we're fighting in Iraq and also in Afghanistan, the problem is the reason why we're there, the lies that we were told about, as the other person said earlier, about the weapons of mass destruction, the reasons why they gave us for this war. And our men and women are dying for an unjust war, and they need to come home now.
You say that you're concerned that your husband is feeling the consequences of your speaking out.
Yes. My husband had been serving in Ramadi for the last 7 months, and his particular unit that he's serving in, they do public affairs and communication, so they all have all the equipment to be able to communicate with us. I feel very, very lucky all that time that nearly on a daily basis I was able to have some form of communication, most generally an email or even an instant message with my husband. But since I've been speaking out for the last few weeks, I know for a fact that my husband told me that the report, the general in that particular area, gets a report twice a day, and my name came up in the report one day. And now, last week, my husband was sent away to another area that I don't know where he's at, but he obviously has no way to communicate with me because I've heard nothing from him except for a couple of nights ago I got a phone call, a collect phone call from him in the middle of the night, and he told me that he felt like this was in retribution for me speaking out and to silence him.
Candace Robinson, have you felt any of the kind of pressure that Jerry Sheesy is feeling right now?
Oh, yeah. My name also came up in a report that my husband got, and he was called to the battalion commander's office over me speaking out, and he told them whether he agrees with what I'm doing or not, he wouldn't stop me from doing it, although he does think what I'm doing is right because I feel so passionately about it. But he had an altercation with another soldier who's one of his family members made a threat against me and my children, and because of it, they moved my husband to battalion headquarters to separate the two guys.
Jane Bright, I know you have to leave, but I wanted to ask your views on the Bush administration policy of not showing pictures of the caskets as they return home. What happened in your son's case, in Evan's case?
We were told that we could not use his casket. He was flown from Iraq to Dover.
Could you speak a little bit louder?
He was flown from...
Somehow we're not able to hear you. We're going to try to bring down the other phone.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, much, much better. Thanks.
Okay, he was flown from Iraq to Dover and from Dover to Burbank Airport. And we asked if we could meet his casket when he arrived in Burbank, and we were told in no uncertain terms by the Army that no family members could be there, that only military personnel could be there. I think it's clear that as the numbers mount, for instance, the 16 that were killed 2 weeks ago and the six this past week from my husband's unit, that as those numbers accumulate and as Americans start to see the caskets lined up, there is going to be an outcry. Right now, it's a slow, small rumble. It's these wives, these brave wives, and parents like me who, I mean, I feel like I have nothing to lose. What can they do to me now? You know, take my other son. I that's what they can do now, is they can take my other son and enlist him. If the draft, you know, I mean, I know that that's a different discussion, but we're heading down the path of a draft, of reinstating the draft. Anyway, back to the caskets arriving in Dover. I think it's clearly the program of secrecy that has been part of the Bush administration from the time they stole the election in 2000. It's all about secrecy. It's all about preemption. That's what I think.
Can you talk about Sergeant Evan Ashcraft's condition before he died, your son Evan?
Evan was living in subhuman conditions. He had lost 25 pounds from dysentery. He often called his wife one day, and she said, "Evan, you sound up. You know what's going on?" And he said, "I just got food and water." I'm not going to misrepresent it by saying that all the time, but there were quite a few times when they didn't have enough food, they didn't have potable water. The conditions are not good. This is part of Rumsfeld's lighter, swifter army, I believe, is to use them and throw them away.
Candace Robison, your son currently in, your husband currently in Iraq, has he had any kind of similar experiences to what Jane Bright is describing?
He's been sick pretty much since he got there. Now the guys all make a joke about whose turn it's going to be this week to have the stomach virus that they all get, that Pepto-Bismol won't even help. My husband weighed 215 when he left, and he's 193 pounds right now. But now that he's in Fallujah, the conditions have really improved for them. They just got a new actual mess hall built. We can thank Brown and Root for that one. And conditions are a lot better. But when he first got there in Kuwait, they were finding maggots in their food. That's how disgusting it was.
Mm. What happens if soldiers in Iraq speak out? Today in our news headlines, we had a piece about Congress members calling on Rumsfeld to resign. But more than a month ago, soldiers on the front line told the National News Network, I think it was ABC Evening News, that they wanted Rumsfeld to resign. What kind of discussion is going on amongst the troops?
My husband was attached to the 3rd ID when that happened, when those guys spoke out, and he said that the next day there was a very high-ranking officer there in Fallujah telling them that if they spoke with the media again, that they would all face court-martial. So they're not allowed to speak out, which, of course, they have there's some rules, and I'm not sure what they are within the Army, that you're not supposed to speak with the media or not supposed to, I guess, say anything negative. But after the way these guys are being treated, you know, I don't blame them for saying it. I'd be frustrated and upset, too.
Candace, I know you have to take your child to school, so thank you very much for joining us. Jerry Shisi, your discussion among other military families.
Well, my husband is a member of a very small unit, and recently there had been a few of the wives who decided they were going to speak out. And yesterday I was told by them that after what happened to my husband being sent away and isolated in this area, that they were no longer going to say anything because they were afraid the same thing would happen to their husbands.
So you're feeling repercussions from having spoken out and other family members' response?
Yes, but you know, when my husband called me in the middle of the night, that was the one thing, the point that he wanted to get through to me before we got cut off. He said, honey, keep doing what you're doing. Don't stop. Just, you have to keep doing this and telling the world what is going on over here. Unfortunately, I won't hear from him because he, you know, was able to tell me some things, and now I won't have any more fresh information.
Jane Bright, I know you too have to leave. Words of advice for other family members of people who are in the Gulf, or family members who've lost loved ones like you've lost Evan?
Well, I always made it very clear to Evan that I supported him, that he had made a choice and I supported his choice regardless of how I felt about the war. And I guess what I would say to other parents who have children there, who've lost children, keep supporting them, because when they come back, I believe that the need is going to be so, so terrific in terms of their mental health, their physical health, you know, and these wonderful ladies with their husbands. Keep supporting them and let them know we love them, because the way we support them is to try to bring them home and take care of them when they get back.
Finally, we heard the story of Fort Stewart in Georgia, where 700 military families confronted military officers about the situation in Iraq. Are you seeing anything like this level of anger in your communities, Jane Bright or Jerry Shisi?
I wish I was seeing more anger. I live in Los Angeles, and, you know, there's what, how many millions of people here. I would love to see more anger, more demonstrations. But I still believe that this pall of the Bush administration, if you speak out, you're pro-terrorist. I'm afraid that still hangs over us. We need to be speaking out more.
And Jerry Shisi.
You know, I'm in Indiana, so I feel completely isolated. It's a pretty conservative state, but I think because of the fear that grew in this country out of 9/11, that unfortunately it's created what I call a huge number of patriotic zombies. And we're afraid that if we say anything negative, then we're no longer patriotic or we're not supporting the troops. I feel like I am doing the utmost to support the troops and my husband, because another solution has to be found. We rushed into this war. We did not have international support. And the administration showed incredible arrogance. And now what they have to do is find some humility. That's the only answer. We have to give up the power and stop acting like Iraq is a prize that we won. We have to give it up and let the UN or some other NGO organizations go in there and try to rebuild it.
Well, I want to thank you all very much for being with us. We've been talking to Jerry Shisi, who's in Indianapolis. Her husband, Douglas Salaweski, is currently deployed in Iraq, as tasked with setting up Iraqi media. Candace Robinson, speaking to us from Texas. Her husband, Army First Lieutenant Mike Robinson, is stationed with the 82nd Airborne Division in Fallujah. And Jane Bright, mother of Sergeant Evan Ashcraft, who died on July 24th, along with two other U.S. soldiers in an ambush near Mosul. She's speaking to us from Los Angeles. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we go to another veteran who was brought back from retirement to investigate the 9/11 attacks. Today, he stands outside Walter Reed Medical Center protesting the invasion. Stay with us. Thank you. Falahi here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Veterans groups are holding a vigil today outside Walter Reed Medical Center, among them vets of the Korean War, the Vietnam War, the Gulf War, and other wars and conflicts. Their protest comes as reports are emerging more than 7,000 U.S. soldiers have been wounded and are being treated at a single military hospital in Germany. Peter Molin is on the line with us now. He was a Department of Defense Middle East analyst for 25 years. He began his military career with the U.S. Army in the Middle East during the 1967 Arab-Israeli War. He then left the military but came back to work at the Pentagon until August 2001 when he retired. After the 9/11 attacks, he was recalled to duty because he speaks fluent Arabic. He was one of the people working on the bin Laden case for the Pentagon. But today he stands in front of Walter Reed Medical Center. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Peter Molin.
Thank you very much, Amy. We're very pleased to be here. And I would like to just mention that the fine ladies that you just spoke to, they are, I believe, all members of Military Families Speak Out, and we are in coalition with them, and they will be represented at our rally today. There will also be rallies, similar rallies, throughout the country at other veterans' hospitals and facilities. So while we're here in Washington, we are celebrating Veterans Day across the country in protest. For two reasons. We would like to point out that while we do honor and support our troops, and that was one of the initial functions of Armistice Day in 1918, that there's another bylaw aspect to Veterans Day. As it was established in 1918, as it became an official U.S. government holiday in 1938, and as its name was changed in 1954 from Armistice Day to Veterans Day to honor veterans of all of our wars, not just the First World War. But in addition to honoring the veterans, there is also in each of the legislation acts that brought about this holiday, a requirement that we rededicate ourselves to world peace and justice. And we believe that the Bush administration is dishonoring both the commitment that is required by today's holiday, legal holiday, to the veterans and to currently serving GIs, as well as to that notion of international peace and justice.
Why to protest in front of Walter Reed Medical Center? Why, for example, not in front of the White House?
We have chosen Walter Reed precisely because it is the medical center, the Army Medical Center, through which all U.S. Army GIs pass on their way to other places here in the United States. You mentioned the 7,000 wounded GIs in Germany, but they will be coming through Dover and through Andrews Air Force Base. They'll be coming through Walter Reed and then going on to their homes and the veterans facilities that will take care of them there. They will be passing through Walter Reed, and we felt that that was a particularly appropriate place to express the views that we're having. You may know that we did have the opportunity yesterday. Veterans for Peace had a delegation go in and visit with a number of the the GIs who are currently recuperating from their wounds there, and we do want to recognize the splendid care that they're getting there from the medical staff and the nursing staff in a state-of-the-art facility. But that, too, is part of the thing that we're concerned with and protesting. As you mentioned, the overcrowded conditions in Germany, the situation at Fort Stewart as the GIs are coming back, the medical facilities here are being overwhelmed. And, of course, that is at a time when tremendous cutbacks are being made. So all the talk about support for the troops that we hear from the White House is belied by the fact that facilities are being closed, charges are being placed on the veterans. We were hearing about them being charged $8 a day for their food while in the hospitals. This administration is is not in support of these troops.
We're talking to Peter Molan, Pentagon Middle East analyst for 25 years. We'll be outside Walter Reed Medical Center today with other veterans groups protesting the invasion. You are in a unique position, Peter Molan, working for the Pentagon for more than 25 years. You retired in August 2001, are recalled after the 9/11 attacks to work on the attacks. You're one of the people working on the bin Laden case, who worked on the bin Laden case for the Pentagon. Can you talk about what you know?
Well, not in technical detail, of course. I am still bound by commitments to classified information. But what I can tell you is that my involvement, my direct immediate involvement, day-to-day involvement with Veterans for Peace arises precisely out of the subsequent decision by the Bush administration to go to war with Iraq. The justifications for that war were completely counter to everything that I had learned in that 20-odd years of government service working on the Middle East, as you say. I was simply outraged by the twisting and turning of intelligence information that I had helped develop to what was clearly, to my mind, a preordained policy decision that I felt to be profoundly wrong. Nothing about this suggests that Saddam Hussein was anything but a brutal dictator. He was. But that's not why we went to war. Had we gone to the United Nations, as Kofi Annan, the Secretary General, has suggested, that the United Nations must reorient its goals from preventing war between states to preventing the sort of things that we see in international terrorism and the suppression of populations by their own governments. The United Nations does have to be reordered towards that goal. Had we done that, I might have been supportive of what the administration is doing. But nothing but poison plants can grow from poison seeds, Amy, and this administration's goals and intentions and policies, which are quite clearly articulated in the security strategy document and in the work of the Project for the New American Century, are completely at odds. They're radically at odds with America's now more than a century-old tradition of trying to build international institutions.
Peter Molan, your thoughts about the polls that say that most Americans believe that Saddam Hussein was connected to 9/11?
I am. They take my breath away. They stun me. I mean, even this administration, although it speaks out of both sides of its mouth, several weeks ago, the president admitted publicly that there was no connection between 9/11 and Saddam Hussein, although he did then turn around the next day and suggest that there was. So there are conflicting stories coming out of the administration, but still, even the administration admits that there was no such connection, and yet more than half of us believe that there is. I can only suggest that Chris Hedges' new book, War Gives Us Meaning, speaks to the kind of psychological advantages that war gives to us, and that we are able to overcome all information to the contrary, all rational thought, in order to follow a war, a lust for war.
Peter Molan?
Yes.
Department of Defense Middle East analyst for 25 years. Let me ask you a little bit about Osama bin Laden and what the administration knew before 9/11 and what they understood afterwards. You've been there for a quarter of a century, mm-hmm, in the Pentagon.
Well, of course, we did know that we had supported him in his involvement in the war, the Afghan war against the Soviet Union, that he was hostile to the United States after the first Gulf War in 1991. We had contacts when he was in the Sudan with the Sudanese government. We didn't bother to take up their offer to hand him over to us. For some reason, that's not entirely clear. We knew that he was involved with the embassy bombings in East Africa. We were working, certainly, to buy 9/11. To find out all that we could about him, but he had gone to ground by that time and was protected by the Taliban regime in Afghanistan. We knew that he was quite hostile, but intelligence is a limited tool. We don't have many persons on the ground, as we know. There've been any number of reasons for that, not least of which are cutbacks in intelligence gathering capabilities. We knew he was hostile to us and that he would try to harm us in any way that he could.
What about the story of John O'Neill, the man who worked in on the FBI counterterrorism unit, tried to investigate the USS Cole, was stopped by Barbara Boudin, the U.S. ambassador to Yemen, tried to investigate links to Saudi Arabia, felt he was prevented from doing so by the Bush administration, and finally gave up, left the FBI, and ended up being head of security at the World Trade Center and died on September 11th.
Yeah. Well, of course, those things do happen. There are internal turf battles. In the case of Mr. O'Neill in Yemen, the ambassador was trying to maintain her relationships with the Yemeni government, and there's a great deal of conflict within the Middle East states. Again, the United States is not well thought of in the Arab world because of its general policies towards the Middle East, and consequently, it's very hard to operate there.
Peter Molin, you were brought back after 9/11 to continue investigating because you speak fluent Arabic. You've been monitoring all the Arab press, Al Jazeera. What do you look for specifically when you're inside the Pentagon, listening to all of that, watching all of that? And what do you think of the difference between what we see here in the United States and what the rest of the world is seeing?
Well, what do we think of the Arab view of us? It is hostile for a variety of reasons. Reasons that we are not able to address, I suppose, for political, current domestic political reasons, such that we are brought into direct conflict with both governments and popular will. Now, that's, I suppose, the thing that we have to understand. Both the Arab governments and the Arab street, as it's called, that is popular opinion, is very hostile to us, and we do a very bad job of trying to address those questions. Charlotte Beers has been hired by the Bush administration, was hired shortly after 9/11, to carry out an increased program of public democracy, public diplomacy, trying to get our story out. But our story has a very hard sell in the Middle East, and she has been, as far as I can tell, absolutely unable to do much of anything.
Charlotte Beer is the PR specialist.
Right. Yeah, I take it because she hasn't got the funding to do much. We have seen very little of American spokespersons getting out and getting their story into the Arab press.
You also went into internet chat rooms.
Yes, I do.
What do you do?
I talk to people. I listen to them. I listen more than I talk, but I do attempt by that means, since I'm not in the Middle East at the moment, to make contact with people who are not government officials, but to get kind of the view of the common person. I do not do that, and we are not able to do that, of course, in the Defense Department per se. But that's something that I do now, and it's one of the sources that I try to use to get the views of the populace.
And what do you do? Do you actually pose as someone?
No. I just say who I am, an American who's been interested professionally for 40 years. You say 25 years in the military, and that's quite true. I was also an academic for a long time. I don't try to hide my identity. I don't make it. I don't publicize the fact that I was an intelligence officer. But I say who I am.
Do intelligence officers who are active now, are they going into these internet chat
rooms?
Well,
that is something that I would have to let you ask them. There's the situation that you were talking about with your earlier guests. The military, of course, is ordered not to speak to the press, to allow only public relations officers to speak to the press. And if you do anything else, you are in breach of orders.
Well, Peter Molin, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Peter Molin will be outside of Walter Reed Medical Center with a number of veterans groups today protesting the invasion of Iraq. The number, again, that has startled many, at least 7,000 U.S. soldiers wounded in Iraq. That does it for today's program. Peter Molin with the Department of Defense for more than a quarter of a century. If you'd like to get a copy of today's program, video or audio, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke and Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, Pervez Sharma. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Also, thanks to Uri Galed and Angela Alston, Simba Russo, Johnny Sender, Rich Kim, John Randolph, Chris Zucker, Dennis Moynihan, Jenny Filippazzo, Isis Phillips, and Carmen Mitchell. I'm Amy Goodman, our website, democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.